Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to the New Books Network. I am Jay Schiffman, founder of Choose Your Struggle, and today I'm chatting with David Herzberg about his new book, White Market Drugs, published by the University of Chicago Press. David is an associate professor of history at the University of Buffalo, and besides the book we're chatting about today, he's also the author of Happy Pills in America, From Milltown to Prozac. David is the co-editor of the journal Social History of Alcohol and Drugs. David, welcome to the show. I'm so delighted to be chatting with you.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So I'll say this, you know, we were chatting a little bit before we started, and so you know my story a little bit. And I'm going to read a quote to you really quick from page 9 of your book. You said that one of your goals for this was to write respectfully about drug consumers, which means writing with care and respect about addiction. And as a guy who's in recovery, I first off want to say thank you for even attempting to do that, because too often, you know, I read these books, some of which I love very much for the book themselves, but they don't really even try for that goal. And other times they try and do not succeed. And I got to tell you, there was not a point in this book where, as a person in recovery, I went, oof, you know, that was a little hurtful. You did not do that whatsoever. And I really do want to start off by just saying thank you for that.
Yeah, well, that's really good to hear. You know, there's a lot of words in the book, and I try my best. It's a tricky topic, as you know, and you know, I really worked hard for that because I do have respect for people who use drugs and for people who used drugs, and I don't want to be a part of robbing them of the dignity that every person deserves.
Well, and we'll get to, I think, interestingly enough, the part that I thought you really pulled the gloves off was the conclusion, where you went straight to it. And I loved it. Every part of that conclusion I thought was right on. But you start out right on page 1. You said in your introduction something that really struck me and stay with me throughout the rest of the book. And I kind of read it through this frame, which is, you spent a lot of this book trying to figure out how you square, as you say, the brutal irony that our drug laws are too weak to restrain Purdue Pharma, but so strong they sent countless people to prison. I thought that was so fascinating as a lens to look at all that you wrote about here. And I would love for you to spend a minute sort of talking about what you meant by that and why that's such an interesting prism for the entire book.
Yeah. Thank you for that question. So in my world, and I think in a lot of places, there's a tendency to assume that pharmaceuticals and drugs are fundamentally different things, right? That one is designed to help people achieve good things like health and stability, and the others are used for perverse purposes, for pleasure and for deviance and things. Even though they're often literally the same substances, or very close if they're not exactly the same. And so one of the things that I was trying to wrestle with in this book is, how do we think past that division, not just at the level of, you know, cocktail party talk of like, aha, they're really the same thing, but really think about how would we talk about drug policy, how we talk about drug cultures, drug practices, drug economies, if we started from the position that these are all the same thing, the same substances, and the same set of human behaviors and human activities, and we want to understand how those differences were produced over time. we don't start by assuming we're looking at two different things. And so, of course, we're seeing two different stories. What would happen if they were part of the same story? What would that overall story look like? And it, what it looks like is grim, right? It looks grim. There's a body count on both sides. Like you said there, that we have laws that oftentimes actively encourage unsafe use of pharmaceuticals, insufficient warnings, so that consumers don't know what the risks are. They know a lot about what the potential benefits are, I'm sorry, but not much about the risks, or not enough. So you have this marketplace booming. And then on the other side, you have markets that aren't even designed with consumer safety in mind at all. They're designed to meet the demands of prohibition, which is very different than consumer interests. So the strange part about it was that what looks like this terrible paradoxical irony is actually, you're talking about two types of markets where consumer safety is not your primary concern. And that trying to understand how we came to such a nonsensical position, like if you and I were just starting from ground zero, let's invent a drug policy, we would not arrive there, right? So how did it happen?
Well, and I'll tell you this, when I was actually thinking about where to start with the conversation with you, it was difficult because you do lay it out so perfectly, sort of three different eras, but there were so many thorough lines between these different eras that it made it very difficult to say, oh, well, there's a starting point. No, but there's a starting point. And personally, and this might just be me personally, if the any listeners who have read your book and are now listening to this, I found the most fascinating sort of story at the beginning was what you called the worst case scenario of drug policy failure in talking about the launch of heroin. I thought that was so fascinating. Would you mind sharing a little bit about that?
Sure. I'm glad to. So heroin ends up becoming a blockbuster drug that is a best-selling drug essentially from about the early 1900s through, you know, a couple years ago, really, when it starts to get edged out by fentanyl and other substances in the illicit market. It just so happens that heroin was illegal for most of that time, but it was still this weird, enduring success drug, like well-known by everybody, used by all these people. So it starts out as a pretty unremarkable drug. It's a gloss on morphine. Opioids turn out to be one of these kinds of molecules that you can tinker with and produce all different kinds of analogs that have slightly different qualities, but they're all essentially the same drug. And heroin was one of the earliest interesting analogs of morphine. And it was introduced by a pharmaceutical company, Bayer Pharmaceutical, that people might recognize them, and they make aspirin, right? And which was also introduced around this time. And it's primarily advertised for treating coughs. And it's a pretty minor drug in medicine at this time, but it's got its uses here and there. But what happens is that when authorities criminalize smoking opium, and the final ingredient of this criminalization takes place in 1909, there is this large group of people who have been smoking opium and are not authorized to get medicine from a physician. They've been buying smoking opium and smoking it in kind of social settings. Smoking opium is now illegal. And smoking opium happens to be bulky. It's sticky. It's smelly. It's a terrible product to smuggle. It doesn't have the right qualities for a prohibition market. It's not going to be selected for, it's not incentivized in a market that's prohibited. So this kind of use of opioids, use that's not sanctioned by physicians, that's more social in its use, this market shifts from a bulky, hard to smuggle product to heroin, which is easier to smuggle because it's much smaller and it has no odor. And it also, because it was a minor medical product, it didn't have a bad reputation yet. There hadn't been tons of people becoming addicted to it and producing all these horror stories in the press. It was known as addictive, but it just wasn't used widely enough to have gotten that bad of a reputation yet. That's when the bad reputation came, is when it started to be adopted by you know, what someone like myself at the time might have called the dangerous classes. A middle class, you know, elite person like myself might have looked down my nose at these folks who didn't have good access to the medical system, and I might have given them this menacing term. And when they start to use heroin, heroin becomes a dangerous and scary drug by association with people that I already think are dangerous and scary. And it also, it's the qualities of the drug and the qualities of the market where it's purchased do exacerbate that, right? You don't have people having full information about the drug they're buying. And as a result, it does produce addiction and it does create exigencies in the lifestyles of people who are already living close enough to the edge that that kind of relationship with the drug makes it considerably harder for them in those communities. So you have a problem on your hands, right? You have a drug that's being used in ways that is clearly harming some people, and it's also scaring authorities who are scared by the communities where it's being used. And what they do is, instead of thinking about this as how do we try to improve consumer safety? How do we help these people either use this drug safely or stop using this drug safely? They end up totally criminalizing the drug. So it gets its relatively minor medical uses. Those become illegal for the most part. It's not illegal if you have a bottle that you had from before the law, but essentially it becomes totally illegal. And what this means is you've lost the opportunity to regulate its use with a goal of consumer safety. The people who care about consumer safety, those white markets where physicians and pharmacists, they can't sell it at all. And the only places where you can buy it are places that are way more determined by the need to avoid the police than they are by the need to serve the interests of consumers. So it's kind of, it's a worst case scenario. You lost all the possible benefits and you magnify all the negatives, both the negatives of using a drug with insufficient consumer protections, and also the harms of drug policing, which further make trouble for people who are already, in trouble.
And I'm sure everybody who listens to this network, well, I guess I shouldn't assume, but probably most people know that race and class are very much tied up in the history of drug use and addiction in this country. But one thing that I really found interesting that you highlighted in your book very well, I thought, was that there was a point in the late 1800s and early 1900s that there was an honest belief that only the sort of white upper class struggle with addictions. Everybody else, it was a moral failing that they were able to create these distinctions in their minds. It was a bit of mental gymnastics that this was, you had to have already been pretty well off to struggle with addiction. Otherwise, you were just sort of the riffraff like you were talking about.
Yeah. So, right. I mean, if you look at the way that people discussed or represented addiction in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, when they write about people from the propertied classes, from these white Anglo-Saxon Protestant people who visited doctors and such, they're portrayed, their state is portrayed as horrifying, but they themselves are incredibly sympathetic characters. Like, they're struggling to be free. They're struggling to maintain their dignity against this fearsome foe that's not their fault. They were, this and that. Whereas if you look at the way that drug use is represented in other folks, it's like these are these menacing people who like are purposefully deviant. Like, what they wanted to do, like they wanted to get addicted, they wanted to behave like that, and they like it, and so you look at these two descriptions of humans doing the same damn thing, right? They're both using opioids. They were trying to relieve suffering or pursue pleasure. And as a historian, I find it very difficult to draw the line between those two things. It's a very, both of them are totally normal human activities that can have, risks associated with them, depending on how you're doing it. But they processed that human behavior so differently, even down to the point where I think it's a physician in a medical journal, if I'm remembering right, they're mocking Chinese immigrants for they just think smoking opium is a cure for anything. And this was at the same moment that every doctor across America was prescribing morphine for, like, oh, you got a cough, morphine. Oh, you hurt your wrist, morphine. Oh, you've got your period, morphine. Oh, you've got hiccups, morphine. And they literally were incapable of recognizing that the same thing was happening. It is still astonishing. You can hear it in my voice. Like, I must have been writing on this for 10 years, and it still blows my mind.
And that sort of, again, mental gymnastics that comes from racism and classism is a through line throughout your book, you know, I mean, even to today. But before we get into sort of the modern day, you know, we were talking about the more ancient history of the late 1800s, early 1900s, but you did focus on a middle period between that, the groundwork of this, and then the modern struggle that we find ourselves in now. In your eyes, what is a good story that sort of best illustrates that middle period for us?
Well, I mean, let's see. It depends on whether we're talking about opioids or that. So the book is about it's a history of the three classes of addictive medications or medications that can be potentially addictive. So that's opioids and stimulants and sedatives. And in a way, the most uncharted territory that the book covers, the story that you won't find anywhere else, is the history of opioid pharmaceuticals from the moment heroin was fully criminalized in 1924 to the moment OxyContin comes out in 1996. Like, we got lots of stories of the before heroin, and we got lots of stories of the after OxyContin, but it's just kind of a black box, those 70 years in between. And one of the questions I sort of started out with in writing the book was, everyone's always asking, why did the opioid crisis happen in the 1990s? And I was like, well, wait, given what I know about the history of the pharmaceutical industry, why didn't the opioid crisis happen before 1996? What on earth could have stopped it? I mean, opioids were legal, they were prescribed, they were advertised in medical journals, and every other pharmaceutical that I've ever heard of, you know, gets hyped out the wazoo and gets overprescribed all the time in cycles, this kind of boom-bust cycle. Did that happen with opioids? So a third of the book is devoted to telling this story. And what I found there was pretty surprising and actually difficult to wrestle with. So it turns out that there was a whole parade of would-be OxyContins before OxyContin, some of them the exact same drug, literally oxycodone with a different brand name. And this whole parade of drugs throughout the 20th century, pharmaceutical companies were saying, aha, you know, we solved it. We found a way to make an opioid that isn't going to addict anybody. You can prescribe it for everybody and their brother. This is so great because pain and suffering really suck. And we want a tool to deal with that. And we really do. And we've got it now. This is great. So the question is, you know, why has no one ever heard of any of these miracle drugs? What happened to prevent an explosion of use of these in the past? And the answer is that when in the early 20th century, when the federal government granted itself these incredibly powerful tools to police racialized dope fiends, right? In American society, it's a lot easier to convince white Americans to give the federal government power if the federal government is saying it's going to use that power to police scary black and brown people or immigrants or things like this. This is sort of a recurring pattern in American history. But when the government was given all this power to control and police these populations viewed as scary by the nation's elites, those powers were also usable against the pharmaceutical industry producing opioids, because at the time the law was passed, there wasn't a distinction between pharmaceuticals and illicit markets. So they were just like, here's a heavy club that you can use to beat the head of people who are selling opioids. And who were the people selling opioids at the time? Well, it was the pharmaceutical industry. It was the pharmacists. It was the physicians in a lot of cases. Even those informal markets we were talking about, oftentimes their supply was like a pharmacist who would sell to someone who would then sell on the street. So what happened was that there's this outpost of this incredibly strong regulatory state built around controlling pharmaceutical opioids at a time when you couldn't get anything close to those powers given to the FDA or really any other commercial market. And so the Harry J. Anslinger, the kind of fearsome head of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, rightly known as a racist who was happy to just make up whatever he needed to get his thing done, that dude was partnering with the nation's leading addiction pharmacologists and reading opioid advertisements line by line, negotiating with companies saying, you got to change this line because my pharmacologists say that it's, you know, that this isn't accurate. He was bullying them, saying like, hey, well, you saw what happened to heroin. You know, you got a nice drug here. What if that, it would be a shame if something happened to it too. And the companies are like writing letters saying, oh yes, yeah, sorry, Mr. Anslinger, totally didn't mean to overstep the bounds. And for 70 years, this you have this this challenging irony that the kind of strong controls over big corporations that if you're that you want in a market for dangerous products, that it was achieved, but it was achieved at this terrible price of this racist police power. Like it was bought at the price of not just emphasizing stereotypes of scary immigrants and black and brown people, but literally policing them and locking them up. And so that, you know, one of the questions is, can anything from that be salvaged? Can you salvage some of those strong controls over corporations? Can you achieve them without buying them at this awful cost?
Well, it's funny. Every time someone says, the name Harry J. Anslinger, I just seethe. I think he's one of the forgotten villains of American history that the average person knows nothing about, and yet so many of the horrible things he did still affect us today. It's mind boggling. But yeah. But you. I love a part of your book where you're talking about this moment we had, sort of the late 60s, where, as you described it, we had a confluence of the civil rights movement helping people rethink a lot of the systems that are sort of in place in this country. And you had a bunch of white kids smoking weed and to a lesser extent, as you point out, using heroin, that really gave us an opportunity in this moment to make some changes. And you start seeing some hearings where I love this quote you have from a California representative. He says, mood control substances are legally available and their use is increasing with society's approval. Mood control substances are illegally available and they are increasing, but condemned by society. These two statements are contradictory, but both are true. As a matter of fact, many instances, they're the same drug. No wonder we are rightfully charged with hypocrisy. What a strong statement, and yet so true.
Yeah. So at that time, one of the things that happens is they managed to put a clamp down on pharmaceutical opioid use, and it's pretty restrictive for 70 years, probably more restrictive than necessary. But there's still a large population of people suffering from a lot of different kinds of psychological distress, and a lot of physicians who want to do something to help them. And so they turn to these different drugs, as specifically sedatives and stimulants. And by the time that guy was speaking, I think in the 1960s, these new white markets for uppers and downers had just blown out the roof because, you know, addiction, according to experts, addiction had gotten associated with these urban, immigrant, or increasingly black and brown populations by mid-century. And so the idea that they were the ones who were at risk of addiction had begun to be common sense amongst the people who were making policy. And so it was hard to convince people you need to rein in sleeping pills and amphetamine stimulants, because, you know, they're being sold by white doctors to white middle-class patients. And these are respectable people. They're not going to become addicted. And so that market was allowed to just spiral out of control. Massive. Like I sometimes struggle to try to explain how, because it happened so long ago, people want to see it as kind of this old-timey drug crisis. But in fact, you know, the number of fatal overdoses, the number of car crashes, the number of suicide attempts were less than the present crisis, but not by an order of magnitude. Like, this was a real serious public health crisis. And this guy was kind of recognizing, like, wait a minute, on the one hand, this country is investing an enormous amount of money in trying to convince people to use these drugs, like an enormous number of resources. A lot of people's jobs are there to convince people to use these drugs. A lot of money goes into building a whole infrastructure whose goal is to put pills in mouths. And at the same time, we're investing all of this money into preventing people from using those same drugs. And he's saying, he's one of these voices at the time saying, we need to challenge this illogical kind of setup and really think about what we're trying to accomplish here. And so it's the start of a really remarkable moment, probably the only moment that gets close to rational drug policy in this whole 150 years. It's a little bit of a depressing thing to say, but you know, at least we got that. It could be nothing, right?
And there's a, so first off, that's so sad that that's our bar, and it's such a low bar, and we can't even clear that one. But you did have another quote in there that there was, I read it and I went back and read it again. And I just had to shake my head. And you had, it was during these same hearings, you had an addiction expert saying control of addiction will never be achieved by sending addicts to jail. That's in the late 60s, early 70s. And here we are in 2021, and we still have not wrapped our mind around that idea. And that, again, as a guy in recovery, was simply maddening.
Yeah, it's one of the things, and I teach on this topic. I teach a history of alcohol and drugs every year, and one of the things that I get most exercised in the class is that the trap of punitive policies is that they don't work, right? That they simply don't work. But when they don't work, it becomes a basis for doubling down on them. Like, look, the problem's getting worse. We need to crack down harder. And the crackdown doesn't work. Well, we need to crack down even harder. Look at these, you know, scofflaws kind of laughing in our face at this. We'll show them. And there's this way in which it's this little bug in the system where failure actually reinforces the policy at hand. So, you know, there's no, it's really clear when you look at the past 150 years, and I hope it's clear from the book, that policies that work are you regulate. What makes drugs especially dangerous is the profits associated with them that convinces companies or people to sell them in ways that are dangerous. And so what works to help protect consumers is to regulate the ability to pursue profit without restraint in selling drugs, like regulate pharmaceutical companies, or regulate anyone who sells drugs, but regulate them with the goal of consumer safety. Don't regulate them with some fantasy that, people are going to know, nobody's going to use drugs anymore now because it's illegal. And I'm sorry, as a historian, like, show me the time and place where that ever happened. No, what we want is that when people do use drugs, that it doesn't become a life-altering bad experience for them. And so, you know, but we keep coming back to these throw them in jail when it's so clear that people's behavior can be, you know, that the behavior of companies and sellers can be so powerfully altered with carrots. Like, there's a good, honest money to be made selling products that people want to use in a safe way. You may not make a killing. You may not make Purdue Pharma money. Maybe you shouldn't be able to make that kind of money selling these products. They're too dangerous. But you know, we can incentivize you by offering an honest profit selling drugs honestly.
So there's definitely a piece on sort of our capitalistic society we live in that we need to talk about, and you do a really amazing job of sort of pointing the finger at that in the conclusion. But before we get to all of that, there is a particular politician that I think bears mentioning in talking about the doubling down on policies that do not work. And you make it very clear in this example that it was done specifically for political reasons. And that, of course, is Rockefeller. What an incredible story of a guy who for a moment looked like to be a champion, or if maybe not, that might be a little strong, but at least somebody who had some good ideas and then just went straight the other direction for completely political reasons.
Yeah, so there's this period of time in the 60s and 70s when, and Rockefeller's part of this, when there's an attempt to rethink drug policy. And this comes from two different directions. On the one hand, you have new regulations limiting big pharma and limiting their sales of sedatives and stimulants that have gone over the top. And then on the other hand, there's this attempt to rethink the punitive approach to non-medical drug sales and use, and really think about, at that time, the alternative was medicalization, seeing like, well, people who use drugs are sick, they need treatment. And Rockefeller was an early believer in the second thing of trying to approach drug users and addiction with treatment. But as it turns out, and I take this from Julie Kohler Hausman's excellent book, Getting Tough, that addiction treatment, politically speaking, it's a really hard sell. Number one, it turns out nobody wants addiction treatment facilities in their neighborhood, and people push back against that. And then when you start to take a marginalized group and you give them the message that they have rights, that they are citizens, that they are humans with dignity, well, it turns out that that's kind of a pain in the neck because people have needs and wants, and they don't always want to do what you tell them to, and they don't always agree with your vision of things. And so politicians like Rockefeller, he invests in this stuff, and he just ends up pissing everybody off at him. And he's like, you know what? When I look at the scene, I'm already known as a liberal in a party that's getting conservative, and I'm not getting any dividends from this policy. To boot, it's also not working for reasons that we could talk about as well. Like by his definition of working, it's not working. And so he decides, I'm going to go the other direction. I'm going to make a bold 180. I'm going to say to the public, look, I invested in all this stuff. I thought it was right, but turns out we tried it. It didn't work. I'm going to go the other way. We need to just lock people up. His original bill that he proposed was like life in prison, first offense, like no possibility of parole. It comes out a little less draconian than that, but like that's probably the only, I think that probably 90% of the times you see the word draconian in popular usage is in reference to Nelson Rockefeller's drug laws, the draconian Nelson Rockefeller laws. But they really were, right? And he starts this mad race to end that experiment with addiction treatment and liberal approaches to addiction, and to really re-emphasize the crime associated with drug use. And it doesn't get funded properly until, Democrats are in power in Washington, and they are the ones who do things like fund massive expansions of the carceral system. But all the legal fundaments are put into place starting with Rockefeller in 1973. It's one of these tragic things, because you had something that, by my mind was really working in the early 1970s. And it's like it was a hot stove, like, America cannot have anything even approaching rational drug policy. Like, let's back away from that hard. First, let's lock up all the non-medical people. And then, hey, let's just free the pharmaceutical industry to sell willy-nilly, because, we got to back away from both sides of this moment of sanity in drug policy. That was a sad part of the book to write.
It's funny. I can't imagine that there was much of this that wasn't sad to write. But yes, that this period was especially tough to read. And you show, again, I'm going to keep using the same word I've been using all along, which is these thorough lines, but you show that starting after this, like you said, kind of freeing the pharmaceutical companies, and one of the major sources of this sort of expansion is direct-to-consumer advertising, which explodes at a rate that if we were looking at anything else, I think rightfully so, we'd go, oh my God, this is really troublesome. But because it's advertising, I don't want to say no one, but there hasn't been that much focus on it. And the numbers for listeners, just to help you understand, you say it went from 1.2 million in 1989 to 2.24 billion in 1999, which is unreal.
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, if you don't mind, before even I leap into that, I want to make clear one of those through lines you were talking about, which is that role of race. I didn't mention it in the Rockefeller story, but one of the preconditions for that moment of sanity in American drug policy, one of the preconditions was civil rights activism and second wave feminism, because the civil rights activists, what they did is they challenged some of those scary racial stereotypes in white people's minds that made it make sense to take people who are struggling with substance use and like say, oh, we actually think you're a criminal and you should go to jail. And so those racial stereotypes had powered that approach since the late 19th century with Chinese immigrants and Southern Eastern European immigrants, and then when you had African American and Latinx migration into northern cities. It was all there to power it. And civil rights activists really took the fight to the white communities that had been voting for those punitive laws and said, look, you know, we're human beings, we have dignity, like you can really recognize us as kin. And that made it, that helped make it politically possible to imagine new ways to approach that issue. And at the same time, the feminists, or at least one branch of the feminists, a really strong one, was the women's health movement. And they were basically, they saw that, you know, what better example can you have of medical sexism than doctors, like women coming to doctors, being unhappy about X, Y, or Z, and doctors just being like, oh my God, you're such a, women are such a pain in the ass, always coming to complain about X or Y, you know, you should be happy mopping the floor here, take some Valium and you'll be happy mopping the floor. And the feminists are coming along and saying, all of this addiction to these drugs that doctors are throwing at women, that this is an example of medical sexism, and this is something that we need to take women's problems seriously, et cetera, et cetera. And so they help initiate a conversation about pharmaceuticals and rethinking, well, wait a minute, maybe they're not all just safe. Maybe doctors don't necessarily have patients' best interests in mind, or maybe they don't always know how to best meet their patients' interests. And so this racial and gender politics made it possible to rethink both sides of this failing drug policy and really reconsider and really enable people to make the connection in their minds between people who are taking pills prescribed by doctors and people who are taking heroin sold on the street and say, wait, they're kind of having the same experience. I couldn't see that before because I had all these racial blinders on. I had all these gender blinders on. And so what Rockefeller is doing is he's like, you know, racial stereotypes and gender stereotypes have really been a political winner in American history. And there's a way in which all those drug warriors, Nixon and Reagan after, who followed his footsteps, well, I guess Nixon was a little too late to follow in his footsteps, but they were leaning into those racial divisions that helped both make it believable that non-medical drug users were these scary criminals, and also believable that somehow white people didn't run a risk of addiction even when they were taking addictive drugs. So I'm sorry, that was a long detour, but I wanted to make sure, because that helps explain why, like, why would you say, yeah, advertise the heck out of Xanax or Adderall or these things, because the assumption is that somehow the whiteness that you assume is there of patients, people who can access the medical system, that's going to protect them. They're not, you know, those addictive type people.
And you make that very clear, because when we talk about what has been called the opioid epidemic, which really we need to start saying instead is the overdose epidemic, but specifically about opioids, you know, you have the three names of Foley, Portnoy, and Haddox, but you have this claim that opioids are not addictive. And as you say so incredibly perfectly in this, going to that point you just made, that this this idea that they're not addictive is a new tool to accomplish the old task of showing that white market drug consumption is different in some way than black market drug consumption.
Yeah, so this was an area where, frankly, I had a lot of trepidation about releasing this book into the public, because there, for a lot of really good reasons, people make a distinction between dependence and addiction today, and they, in talking about drug use, and I understand and support the goals of doing this. As a historian, I ran into this trouble, which is that in trying to distinguish between, you know, you have a whole bunch of people who are taking a drug regularly over a long period of time, it's such that they are never not taking the drug, right? So they are chronic consumers. And there's been, since the late 19th century, there's been an effort to draw a distinction between like the good people doing that and the bad people doing that. There's good people doing that and bad people doing that. And there's been these different terms like, well, one people, they're habitués or they're habituated, and the other people are like dope fiends or junkies, or that some people are dependent and other people are addicted. And the goal was to try to make it make sense that we were going to treat those people really differently. But from a historian's point of view, it seemed like a whole bunch of the difference between those people was like simply their level of access to a safe supply. Like the people who had a safe supply looked like they were dependent, and the people who didn't have a safe supply looked like they were addicted. I mean, I'm sure, I know that that nothing covers every case with humanity, but that seemed like a really big thing. So I decided not to use those terms. And how that comes down, how that becomes relevant to the point you raised, is that in talking about some of the language that was developed to defend chronic pain patients' access to opioids. And this is something like J. David Haddock's term, pseudo-addiction. If you've read about the opioid crisis, one of these books, you will have heard this term. And the idea was, if you have a pain patient who is exhibiting symptoms that look like addiction, like they take their script to two different pharmacies, or they hoard their pills, or they run out of them too quick, they're not actually addicted. The problem is that you haven't given them enough opioids to ease their pain. And so the solution is provide them more opioids. Now, this becomes something that people point to as like example of the pharmaceutical industry completely buying off the medical system. But I have a more complex read here. On the one hand, this is kind of the perfect encapsulation of this desire to separate the good people who use drugs from the bad, because there's literally, according to this theory, there's almost nothing you could do as a pain patient that would qualify you as addicted. Like you could buy drugs off the street, and this is an example he gives, and that, nope, that doesn't mean you're addicted. You could hold up a liquor store, and nope, that doesn't mean. So what they're basically saying is, if you have been anointed as a patient, if you have health insurance and can go to a doctor, you literally can't become addicted. Whereas if you don't go to the doctor, it does not matter how you are using that drug. If you're not a pain patient, you're a criminal, right? And so what I was thinking is, okay, if the point is that people who are addicted, people who are dependent, addicted, whatever word you're going to use, if they should have access to a safe supply because they're going to use drugs, like why are we reserving that just for pain patients? Like why shouldn't someone who hasn't been given the blessing of a doctor but who's addicted, like why shouldn't they, if you're defending their right to a safe, the right to a safe supply, why only defend that right for the class of people who have access to the medical system? So to me, it's a really complicated ethical question that I think becomes much simpler when you recognize this 100-year-old effort to try to use class and race distinctions to dignify some people's drug use as okay, and other people's drug use as by definition deviant and bad for them.
That is a wonderful response to something that is very hard to talk about in ways that I think a lot of people understand. Although, you know, I think that with this network, people tend to get it a little bit more than you know the average person on the street. And you know that is something that a writer that I love, David Poses, wrote about in his book, which mm-hmm. was that, you know, he did find a drug that, that took away his depression. It was called heroin. Yeah. It just is not the one that you can buy from the store. And how for some people, they just could not wrap their mind around that, 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 mm-hmm. that you know, is it, he was using it in a way that if he had been buying something from a pharmacy, that would be more accepted. It is a very hard distinction that you and I could talk for another hour and still not be anywhere close to illuminating in ways that some people would mm-hmm. understand. I, as we're getting towards the close, though, I do want to sort of talk about one bigger, more meatier topic with this. And that is, as I mentioned on the way in, I loved your conclusion to this book. I loved, as I kind of said, that you seemed to take the gloves off and really went in this conclusion. You start off by saying the history of American drug policy offers precious few success stories, which I thought was a perfect sentence. And you go from there to say that, you know, the end of chapter one is depressingly static. It is similar. The whole thing is depressingly static as the end of chapter seven. So my question for you is, as we talk about all of these sort of ideas and we agree that we're kind of depressingly static over this period, what can everybody in their lives do to help make a difference for drug users and those who struggle with substance misuse? Because this book is wonderful. I enjoyed it as someone who gets up every day and works towards these goals. But who is your intended audience, and how can people who read this take this information and go, all right, I can make a change with this?
It's a great question. And I'm going to say, right at the start, one of the intended audiences is historians, and I'd be glad to talk about what that means. But I think there are two other intended audiences. One is that I hope that people who participate in making policy, and this is not just politicians and their legislative aides and all that, these are advocates, these are voters. I hope that everyone who participates in that process can just get a clarifying sense of what are our goals in drug policy. And I try to introduce, think about people who use drugs as consumers, think about drugs as highly desirable but highly dangerous goods, like maybe automobiles, and that our goal is consumer safety. And that means that we didn't arrest people who drove Volkswagens that had fraudulent emissions tests. We cracked down on Volkswagen the goal is to pursue safe regulations that will make it less dangerous to do this human activity that we're not going to stop. So I think that once you have a firm understanding of what the goal is, it can allow you to see through some of the fog and, frankly, bullshit that gets circulated around in lieu of real talk about drugs in our political discourse, and allows you to craft more sensible policies and to vote for people who are advocating those policies. And I would just say that I feel like I go between these two different groups who often don't really have a lot of appreciation for each other, put it that way, like that people who are anti-pharma, like who are the kind of the left wingers who are like anti-corporate and these big pharma people, and the anti-drug war people who are a different part of the left, like looking particularly at race issues and the new Jim Crow and this kind of thing. And I often like I'm the token party pooper in each group, like for the anti-pharma people, I'm like, you know, you can't buy leverage over this big industry by trading in harmful stereotypes of people who use drugs there's no way to do that that isn't racist. There's no way to do that that isn't stigmatizing and harmful. You have to tell a story about these that is about unregulated capitalism. That's not about ooh scary drugs. It's just about unregulated, ooh scary unregulated capitalism. And then on the other side, I find, you know, I love David Pose's book as well. And sometimes when I'm talking to groups who represent that point of view, there's this kind of sneaky libertarianism in there that they're like, that implicitly they seem to be just saying like, yeah, it should all just be legal. And I'm like, wow, you do not want, whatever, GlaxoSmithKline, Wellcome, Sanofi, whatever planet bestriding corporation having just free reign to sell a drug that has real risks, however they want. There's that kind of hue to that middle line of you want a safe supply, and safe supply in a capitalist context means really strong regulations of the suppliers. And I think what I hope is that at the political level, people will keep that in mind, that it's not an either or, it's not either free market or prohibition. Those are both terrible approaches. You want a genuinely safe supply, which requires a lot of regulation. And then at a day-to-day personal level, just radically demystify drugs, radically demystify the harms associated with drugs. We don't need special terms for people who use drugs. They are just consumers who are buying a product. We don't need special terms for drug dangers. All products carry risks. And what we try to make it so that people are less likely to face those risks. Drugs are the same. They're not some magically different type of consumer good. They're not some magically different type of activity. They don't represent magically different human urges. They are very much a part of what we do every day, both in our economy and our personal lives. And we need to radically destigmatize and demystify and just accept the normality of using drugs and the normality of there being risks to using products, and just, you know, dispense with this magic that was built out of racism and fears of miscegenation and all this stuff that, you know, it's a century old. We need to just reject all of that and radically rethink the people who use drugs in your life, the people who used to use drugs in your life, and just normalize it, not in the way of saying that we no longer care about people's safety and just do whatever you want, but normalize it in the way that we care about people's safety in everything they do. And we can care about it in the same way. I'm sorry, I'm getting off on a little bit of a rant here, but and I'll cut myself off there before I just launch into the stratosphere.
No, I love it. And it brings me around to what I want to be the last question is, you know, we are actually recording this on the day that it was announced that New York is going to try safe consumption sites, which is wonderful. So I guess my final question with that in mind is I'm with you on the safe supply. I think that is the most important point that is not ever given too much of a focus here. But because so much of your book was tough, I mean, reading this history was tough. What gives you hope? What after doing all this work makes you think? Because some of the things you just said are exactly right, very lofty when it comes to the political change. So what is it that gives you hope?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, historians don't often get to say this. And so I'm like, I love getting to say this because there is something new under the sun. And the something new under the sun is, from my point of view, is the harm reduction movement. And that is, in all of this history that I've been telling, there's been a key voice absent in who was making decisions about drug policy, and that was people who use drugs. Everybody's talking about them. Everybody's trying to make decisions that they think are in their best interest or that are protecting people from them, but their own voices have been really disparaged and marginalized. And you know, to have organized collective action on the part of people who use drugs, inserting their point of view, insisting on their voices in this conversation, and in some cases, like in at least in the New York chapter of the Drug Policy Alliance, being explicitly anti-racist, like recognizing that you can't do good drug policy. Like, there is no colorblind good drug policy, right? You have to be actively anti-racist to have any hope of achieving what you need to achieve there. I find it really inspiring. I mean, these are such impressive people, and the motivation of love that drives them is just like, you know, I find it really moving and inspiring. And because it is new, it gives me hope that that the dance will change this time. You know, one of the partners is not following the same steps. And this safe consumption rooms is an example. Like that's inconceivable like that there's no point at which there was anything approaching any possibility that was going to happen in the 150 years of history that I've been writing on this book. And yet in some sense, it's so logical. It's like, hey, we should build roads to drive cars on because it'll be way safer. Like, you know, we should, if, you know, how do we use this product safely? I got an idea. You know, how about paved roads or how about safe consumption sites? It makes a lot of sense. But every little achievement like that, I think it comes from people who broke that Gordian knot of, you know, going back and forth between medicalizing and prohibition, which is kind of between two different groups that whose goal is to control people into abstinence. When abstinence, at least at a social society-wide level, is not a realistic goal, that they're really succeeding in changing the terms. And I hope, you know, it's hard to be too optimistic as a historian, you know, because you've seen so much under the bridge, but they really do. And if our fate is going to be in anyone's hands, like I would be glad that it's in their hands.
I think that is a perfect place to end this with a call to have more people who use drugs at the table. I echo that. I love that very much. And that's one of the stated goals of my organization, Choose Your Struggle. David, it was wonderful chatting with you. Everybody, please, please, please go out and buy the book, White Market Drugs. I think David will agree with me when I say support your local bookstore or check out somewhere like bookshop.org and support their work. David, any final word for the listeners?
You know, just thanks. I love having a chance to talk about this. Thank you for your time.
Definitely. Well, thanks so much. And everybody, check out the next episode of the New Books Network, wherever you get your podcast. Thanks so much.